Welcome to the Manifestation Lab. This is your host, Kelly Howe. From the grounded science to the mystical and unseen, we're investigating this big experiment we call life and finding what really works when it comes to manifesting a life that sets your heart and your soul on fire. Welcome to the lab. Welcome back. Been a little bit of a wait, but we're back, and I have been completely and honestly frozen in perfectionism. I don't know if you guys ever deal with that. I have come so far with my perfectionistic tendencies. Really, the only place that this shows up is with work. It's things like the podcast, big projects that I'm working on. And my perfectionism is so ridiculously sneaky that probably no one on the planet would even know that I'm a perfectionist or call me that. And before I really realized what was going on, I would have been the first person to say, I am not a perfectionist, but it definitely is what I call a closet perfectionism. So it's like, I deep down didn't believe that I could actually get something done to the degree that I believe is possible, with very high expectations and very high standards. And so that I would just convince myself that I didn't care. I don't care about that. And I recognized a few weeks ago that I was really sliding back into that pattern. Now, luckily, when you're doing personal development work for a really long time, you start to notice your patterns. Yes, they get better over time. Yes, there's a lot of healing work that you can do to get to the root cause of perfectionism. But in the end, sometimes this is just kind of part of who we are. It's part of who we came here to be. And I keep working on it. I keep trying to find, like, where does this come from? Of course, it comes from a fear of failure and, you know, all kinds of fears underneath it. But I have come to the point where I really truly believe that, yes, it comes from this life, but I'm also working with a lot of lifetimes of wounding. So I do my best. I notice my perfectionistic patterns, and then I start tapping and I work through the resistance to getting the thing done. Here's what's really fun. My perfectionistic patterns started showing up again after I had an amazing conversation with Dr. Peta Stapleton. Now, she's going to laugh at this when she hears this, but the first thing I said to her when I talked to her for the podcast was, Peta, I think you're so cool. And I wasn't lying. I'm a little bit fangirl about the fact that I got to talk to her. If you are in the EFT industry, if you're into tapping at all, you've probably heard her name. In fact, we just had the big annual Tapping World Summit, and Peta was on, I think, the first several days doing talks about the research behind tapping. She is truly a leading expert in the field. She is spearheading new research. She's also one of the people that's bringing that research together so that we can look at how valid it is and really do better studies and really get to the science behind how is this really working? How does this work? Why does this work? And I'm just really excited about all of the work that she's doing. I have followed her work for a really long time. I've seen her TED Talk, and I do think she is very cool. She's also a brilliant woman and incredibly smart, deeply spiritual. She has fantastic energy, and we had a complete blast talking. The podcast was way, way, way fun, but it was really interesting and kind of funny to me that because I've followed her for a long time, I got all wiggy and like wonky about doing this introduction and about editing it and all kinds of really funny and ridiculous things. And it's interesting because I tapped on it. I recognized it. I can have a sense of humor about it. And here I am. It's no big deal. So let me tell you a little bit more about Dr. Peta Stapleton. She is a registered clinical health psychologist and associate professor at Bond University in Australia, who embraces evidence-based and innovative techniques. Peta is a world-leading researcher in emotional freedom techniques, also called tapping, and led a world-first study investigating brain changes after EFT. And yes, you heard that right. I believe she used fMRI to study the brain while they were doing tapping. And they are finding that tapping isn't just, as she said, it's not just a, quote, feel-good technique. We are actually making real changes that can be seen in the brain. It is so exciting. PETA won the Harvey Baker Research Award for Meticulous Research through the Association of Comprehensive Energy Psychology and was named 2019 Psychologist of the Year by the Australian Allied Health Awards. PETA has authored The Science Behind Tapping, a Proven Stress Management Technique for Mind and Body, and she also won Best Self-Help Book in 2019 at the American Book Fest and the Best Book Awards. She's so amazing. I really love her. And she was such a joy to talk to. She has another book coming out, she said, later this year. So we're already talking about having a conversation for that next book, which is all about using tapping, and I would imagine other tools for memory. Now, I have a ton of memory issues in my family. People tend to live a very long time, but unfortunately, historically, their minds don't make it with them. So I'm going to be the first person to sign up and order that book and, you know, really spearhead and go after whatever the root causes and blocks and whatever is underneath psychologically that I can find to help work through those blocks. Because of course, I want to keep my mind. I want to live to be 150 and be vibrant and healthy and have my mind intact the entire time. So really looking forward to getting my hands on that book. You can find PETA at www.petastapleton.com and also at evidencebasedeft.com. She has a bunch of social handles that I will link in the show notes. She also has a course and she's done research on tapping for weight loss and food cravings and emotional eating. And I will link that course also in the show notes. And she also has a course called Tapping in the Classroom. And I think that she and I both agree, we talk about some of this in the podcast, that if we can get this tool, this miraculous tool in the hands of children, in the hands of educators and counselors, and get kids doing this at a really, really young age and teach them to view emotions differently, to process them from a young age, to be able to just shift the perspective around emotional healing and around emotional hygiene and emotional well-being. I think we both agree that it would truly change the way the world operates. Can you imagine these little kids growing up just doing tapping every day in the classroom, and then they grow up to be a doctor or they grow up to be a teacher and they pass it on to their patients or their students? It's just really exciting. When you grow up and something is normal, it's no big deal to just share it with other people. You know, it works. And I think it's super exciting. So I know you guys are really going to enjoy this. I'm a little bit fangirl over here about Dr. PETA Stapleton, and I think you're just really going to like it. So enjoy. I have to admit, this is a manifestation coming true for me. So that's fun. It's really,
wow,
really fun.
That's fabulous. That's so cool.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I think you're like the coolest thing out there, PETA.
I know we're being recorded. Oh, that's just lovely. Thank you.
No, this is actually, this is what my podcast is all about. I love catching the candid moments, but it is true. I think you're super cool. And
and I've been wanting to, yeah. That when I go home, and you go, people think I'm super cool, they'll just laugh.
You know what? I'm going to send you this portion of the recording, and you can just put it on your phone when you're having one of those days. You'll be like, you know what? Yeah. People in America think I'm cool.
That's so cool. Thank you, Kelly.
You're welcome. Well, listen, I know that you're the queen bee of the science of tapping. And funny enough, I have been putting together a science of tapping podcast episode that I was going to solo, but I honestly was on your Gaia show. I was like pulling together all this stuff and I was really literally just going to parakeet back everything that you say. So I thought, why not just, you know, talk to you directly and get all this information from the source. I'm so obsessed with everything that you're putting together and pulling out for the EFT community. And it's just so exciting. So I want to start with, yes, we're going to get into the science. Yep. We're going to go there for sure, for sure. Yep. But I want to know, what was your upbringing like? And how did that lead you to wanting to get into the psychology space?
Oh, wow. I don't think anyone's ever asked me that on a podcast, but let's go there. So I wanted to be a lawyer. I didn't even know psychology existed, and it was, you know, back in my day, quite a new field, not so much these days. Every child wants to be a psychologist. But I watched too many law shows, particularly an American LA Law with Corbin Bernstein. So I'm just like, oh, I could be a lawyer. I think it was, I was probably drawn to wanting to defend people. And it was more that kind of, more so than the prosecution. And, you know, quite liked, come from a family of teachers, so quite liked the idea of standing in a courtroom and, you know, doing some sort of, which is funny for an introvert, of course, you know, to.
Oh, I've got that too. I'm one of those like ambivert, you know, I've got a lot of introvert qualities, but then here I am doing this, so I get it.
Totally. But the other flip side of that was I was an anxious child. So I am the eldest and just I didn't know at the time, but I probably actually would have been diagnosed with generalized anxiety disorder. I was just a worrier. I was quiet. I was an introvert. I was incredibly perceptive and intuitive, but I didn't know that was a strength necessarily. So therefore, I would misread my body sensations as something bad was going to happen more so than, you know, a high emotional intelligence or whatever. So that was sort of in the background. By the time I get to university and I do a year of law and went, oh, this is a bit dry and boring. And I was looking through the handbook to find an elective subject and found Psychology 101, did it and went, why have I never heard that you can change your thoughts and you can change, you know, your life and, of course, change my whole degree. And it was sort of a couple of years after that that in running a lot of eating disorder support groups, because that was my clinical area, because I just understood the anxiety behind those kind of body concerns, a colleague at the time said, oh, I've come across this really weird technique and I wrote about this in my book and I had no idea what it was talking about. I'm like, what are you saying? And he's like, it's a bit strange, but I think it works for anxiety. I dismissed him for a couple of months and then saw an outcome in the support group of a young girl. She was having a panic attack. He took her outside within a couple of minutes. She was calm. And, of course, that then led me to wanting to know what was this weird technique. But the application in the early days was for myself. So yeah. I profoundly shifted my own nervous system because I'm like, I finally found, and meditation wasn't a thing really at the time, but I'd finally found something for me that helped me be calm and regulate my system. And then, of course, you know, it rolled out into the research world. But to this day, people would laugh if I said, oh, look, I was a really anxious, worrying, introverted child. People would be like, no, you weren't. Like, yes, I was.
Oh, yes, I was. Oh, yes, I was. I am exactly the same. I'm not the oldest. I was the middle kid. So I had an older sister that was 6 years older and a younger sister that was 2 years younger. So, but I had so much of that same, like I just worried about everyone and just so much physical, visceral experience with that worry. And I never had a diagnosis either. And I don't think anybody around me probably would have thought that because I was, you know, fine, but I was not fine. And tapping was the same for me. I was definitely, I had to like have this come to Jesus of like, I guess I have anxiety. And even still, when I say that, I have friends that are like, really? And I'm like, oh yeah. Oh yeah. Like it was so bad. And I didn't even know I was in complete denial and just unawareness that that was what that was. So my listeners are really comfortable and used to me talking about tapping, but I'm really comfortable talking about like the more woo-woo side of it. But I also obviously love the science side of it. My background is in nursing and I'm like split down the middle. Like I really need to know the facts, ma'am. You know, I need to know about what's really going on here. And the more I learn about, you know, quantum physics and things, and the more I learn about how energy really does affect our body, I can go out there as far as it goes and I don't care, you know. But for our audience, I would love for you to give a description, you know, a proper description of what tapping is and like, how does this really work? What are we finding?
Absolutely. So in its simplest terms, if someone sort of said, you know, what is this EFT tapping thing? It really is a stress reduction technique. So you might think of other things in that category, if you like, you know, deep breathing techniques or progressive muscular relaxation or whatever. So it is simply a way to reduce stress. From a more academic point of view, we might say, look, it's a psychophysiological stress reduction technique. So it's psychological, but it's physiological. And of course, what we're doing is stimulating acupoints, which are known in the human body. Lots of emerging research in the last couple of years around the vascular density points of acupuncture points in the body. So we're stimulating those. What we know from the science and the research is it does have a deactivating signal at that stress center in the brain. So the amygdala that sends out that fight or flight or freeze or faint response, you know, like your kind of fire alarm, it actually has the ability to kind of downregulate that so that someone might be able to then think more clearly about what's happening or if it's a genuine kind of threat, that type of thing. So the reason I guess its application is so wide, because if we start to go, oh, why does it work for this or this or this, it seems like it's kind of magic, and people sometimes will question why can it work for so many different things, from, you know, weight loss, food cravings, to phobias, to chronic pain, to cancer. It's because if we can reduce the stress response, and we actually have loads of data on the physiological stress response, cortisol levels, that hormone, you know, regulation of EEG, brainwave activity, heart rate variability, blood pressure, those kind of things. If we can regulate that physically in the body, then we do get kind of positive outcomes with all those other conditions. And it just might be that someone just thinks more clearly. So the frontal lobe can come back online when that stress response is not taking over. So they might just think of a different solution for something in their life, or just cope and handle their chemotherapy medical treatment better than what it was when they're in that highly stressed state. So yeah, so the application is really wide, but it actually, in its most simple kind of definition, is just a way to reduce stress very quickly in the mind and the body.
Yeah, and I think people typically feel it works so quickly that it draws them in very quickly. I mean, not always, of course, depending on what they've been through, but I think that people feel it. And even if they thought it was crazy, I'm like, just hang with me for a minute. I know this looks bizarre, but just bear with me, because I think you're going to feel it work. So I don't like to bring up old stuff, but I do have a little bit of beef with Wikipedia.
Yep.
So we're going to go there for a second. When I first learned about tapping, you know, 12 years ago, probably now, maybe even longer, of course, that was the first thing I did was, you know, I got into Google and I looked up tapping just to see, like, is this real? Because of course that, like, that nurse ego part of me was like, if this is real, I would have learned about this. I would have heard about this. There's no way, right? Like, I really wanted to believe it was real, but of course I thought, oh, this has just got to be placebo. And of course, the first thing that popped up was Wikipedia. And just to kind of give the listeners, you know, a brief on the Wikipedia drama, I know that academics like you and all over the world, people have been attempting to change the language on Wikipedia's website since I've known about it. So at least 12 years, probably longer than that. And despite how many times people change it, they have this information bias and this gate to real information getting on Wikipedia. So I just popped back on there because I thought, well, maybe they've finally broken through. No, I get on there and it says EFT has no benefit as a therapy beyond the placebo effect. Any known effective psychological techniques that may be provided in addition to the purported quote energy technique, it is generally characterized as pseudoscience. That one I was like, I just have to start tapping because it's just so ridiculous. And it has not garnered any significant support in clinical psychology.
Yeah, true.
So what would you like to say to that?
don't believe everything Wikipedia tells you. And right. Look, you know, whole committees of lots of our professional bodies have dedicated volunteer hours, like thousands of hours, trying to daily update with scientific references and, you know, quality peer-reviewed articles and things like that. Within 24 hours, it gets changed back. So the real question is, okay, so what's the block, I guess, around why it's not acceptable or the evidence that does exist? And we're looking at, you know, over 300 odd publications now, the majority of those on EFT tapping in this kind of field. What is it then that makes people kind of go, no, that doesn't work, or that it's not more than a placebo, even in proper, you know, randomized clinical trials or whatever? And I don't know the full answer for that, because I think it'll be different for everybody. I think there's probably at some level a threatening of the status quo, that we have got gold standard therapies that exist, of which I teach at master's level. So I teach all of those gold standard therapies. And, you know, EFT is an emerging, and we would still say that it's new, it's emerging. It takes around 17 years for a new therapy to be accepted into mainstream. Wow. That's the translational gap. We're at that 17, 18 year mark, and I'll tell you what that means as far as the field. So it does take that long. So when you think of EMDR, the eye movement desensitization therapy, that took about 20 years to now be accepted as perhaps, you know, a better therapy for PTSD and trauma than one of the other gold standard talk therapies. So it took 20 odd years for, and still to this day, people will go, oh no, that doesn't work either. And it's like, okay, well, there's always going to be people that go, it looks weird, it's strange, I can't get my head around why that would work, even though we have got mechanisms. And I do think the beginnings of EFT, which is why we're trying to correct this in, you know, podcast chatting to you, what we write, people still have got some belief, if you like, that tapping is about shifting energy in the body, which is the way it was described 25, 35 years ago when we didn't really have understanding of mechanisms, we didn't have the research. It just seemed to work, and there kind of was just really the Eastern philosophy of acupuncture's contribution. We didn't even have the, we now have like functional MRI studies, you know, scanning studies that show that acupuncture system is physical in the body. So that meridian system that, you know, was often talked about being energetic is not energetic at all. This is the my keynote presentation in Melbourne in a couple of months' time. It's like meridians are physical. They're not energetic.
That's cool. I love
it. So
that.
Cool. So we will record that. So we'll get that out there, yes, at some point. Where, yes, it's, we have images from surgeries that show the primovascular system, you know, being picked up in surgery that's smaller than a capillary. And along that, when you inject dye into it, are vascular densities, juncture points, and that's an acupuncture point. They correspond with those charts that you see when you go into your acupuncture.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wow. And so, don't you wonder, how did they know? I mean,
yes, how did they know? That's the real question, because they knew, but we've taken many, many decades to prove. Actually,
thousands of years. Yeah, they've been talking about these points. It's wild.
Yeah. So none of that was known, you know, 30, 40 years ago, when certainly Gary Craig and even precursors in thought field therapy and other modalities, mm-hmm, similar, they didn't know. So they just talked about energy. I think that information has not been updated in a lot of people that might be skeptical, or even people that, you know, disclaim EFT science. They're stuck in that schema, if you like, of, oh, this is about shifting energy in the body. And it's like, it's got nothing to do with energy. You might feel better, but here's all the biochemistry changes that occur. Here's you in a functional MRI machine, and they're the studies we've been doing. Here's what happens after you do tapping. Here's what happens with your chronic pain in the brain before tapping. Here's what it is after. And that kind of research is yet to sort of get out there to that kind of community. So, mm-hmm, how do we handle Wikipedia? I don't worry about it. Like, I just,
yeah,
okay. And our students going through their schooling systems are taught, do not look to Wikipedia, even if there was something that genuinely was updated. It should not be a source, a credible source, because it's open source, it's open access. Anyone can write anything. I could go in and write something about cognitive behavioral therapy that was inaccurate. So, right, yeah, the students coming through our universities now are like, oh, no one looks at Wikipedia. And I'm like, yeah, oh, so in a couple of generations' time, they just won't ever worry about it.
Well, I'm so happy to hear that is the general consensus. I learned that a long time ago. And I am happy to report that it used to be the first thing that popped up when you would look up what is EFT. It would be like right there at the top. And so I would have clients come to me and say, I looked it up and this is what it said. And, you know, I had to go through the whole rigmarole of, well, this is what's going on. But I am happy to report that it wasn't even on the first page. I had to go hunting and looking for it. So, and I didn't even, you know, I questioned whether I was even going to bring it up, but I wanted to make the point that even when there is really strong evidence towards something, there are these information blocks out there on different sites. And I agree, Wikipedia is not one of the ones that I would go to for accurate information. And I think what's scary is that people can change it. So you could go in and put in wrong information. However, academics like yourself could go in and change this every single day, and real information doesn't somehow make it to the website. So I think I just wanted to, like, you know, key people into, just because you read it somewhere and Wikipedia seems credible, I don't know, at least it used to. Hopefully people are kind of keyed into that now. But Yeah, I just wanted to like show a little bit of like how real information just sometimes doesn't make it out because people have those biases and they just won't let it. So, and I've done much tapping on that frustration. So thank you, Wikipedia. I've gotten so much healing from your ignorance. But okay, so you spoke of the Harvard studies that have been, I think that you said maybe like 10 years that they've been going on. Could you talk about that at all?
Yeah, so Harvard University was one of the first that was looking at acupuncture points in the body and the impact in the brain. So traditional acupuncture, as in put the needle into that acupuncture point. They did a range of kind of scanning studies, so functional MRI, you know, those kind of CAT scans, that type of thing, to see what happens when we put, and this was before we knew the primovascular system was a physical entity in the body. So they would put them in the known acupuncture points, the needles, and have someone, you know, think about something stressful, that type of thing, to see what would happen in the brain. And that is where that information first came out that, if you stimulate an acupuncture point, an acupoint, when you're feeling that, it has a deactivating signal or impact, if you like, on the amygdala. So that research was quite thorough. They spent 10 years researching that. That's all published. People can read that. Obviously, the extension of that has been, you know, the research that in EFT, because we don't use needles, we're just stimulating the point with that tapping technique, has been then looking at, you know, EEG, brainwave activity, functional MRIs, that type of thing, cortisol testing, you know, blood pressure. So extending the biochemistry to say, okay, well, what happens when we do tapping? We stimulate that acupuncture point, not with the needle, but with tapping. Do we get the same impact? And are we getting it physiologically, not just from someone saying, oh, I feel better, or oh, I'm not so worried now, on a subjective level? So the field's been really, I guess, focused on, which a lot of other talk therapies haven't replicated. They just have all these studies that show self-report questionnaires. But EFT really has been focused on looking at the physiological outcomes of this technique, like what happens to the body when we actually do the tapping.
Yeah, and I know that you outlined in the Gaia special, you talked about, I think it was a meta-analysis that talked about the efficacy, and you don't have to go into the details of it, but could you kind of briefly talk about just how exponentially powerful those results were?
Yeah, so there's been a couple of meta-analyses, which just means in layman's terms, there's enough randomized clinical studies, they're the peak of the field, you know, the bee's knees, we call them in Australia, the best. And there's enough of those that you can look at all the data together. So up until kind of, you know, a couple of months ago, there was one on PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. I think there were 7 studies that were analyzed. There was one on depression, one on anxiety, and a couple of others have emerged. We've just updated the PTSD one, my team. So I will talk about, because I want to talk about that translational gap and come back to that in a minute. What we look at in a meta-analysis is compared to maybe a control group, so that could be, you know, a group that waits or does treatment as usual, or it could be a gold standard comparison therapy. So lots of the studies will compare to CBT, EMDR, other narrative therapies, that type of thing. So the effect size that we're looking for in a meta-analysis at a numbers level is, you know, looking at, well, how good is EFT for that condition compared to either one of those others. So normally we look at a number out of 1, so 0 to 1, and that just means the closer it gets to 1 as a decimal, the more that we can really say the outcomes are due to EFT or the treatment that you're investigating. So the effect size for PTSD in that first paper was 2.96, which is a very large effect size. We have updated that paper, added some papers in. Our effect size is about 1.87. So still what we would call a very large effect size. So what that really means, just to kind of, anyone's like, what's the anxiety and depression meta-analysis effect size? Depression was about 1.4 and anxiety was about 1.23, top of my head. So again, they were all very large, meaning the outcomes that the people report in the trial after they've had the treatment, EFT, have to almost be 100% due to the EFT. That is not, and that's what that means, and in comparison to whatever they're comparing to. So, yeah, it's really interesting when you start to have a look at the level of research, and that's really what the academic world wants to see, is okay, well, how good is it compared to something else? And it's like, well, it's this good. And people go, huh, okay.
Right.
So just the comparison to gold standards, because I've done some of those studies, lots of other people have different areas, is EFT shows comparable equal outcomes to gold standard therapies like EMDR, CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, and things like that. So they're established. EFT's outcomes are equal at the time points, which is a good thing, mm-hmm. but they achieve their outcomes in half the time. So if you look at 6 and 12 months down the track, okay, how did it hold up? Oh, yeah, it's the same as CBT, or oh, it got the same outcomes as EMDR. When you look at how long did it take the EFT people to achieve it, then that's where the difference shows. So the difference might be 5 sessions compared to 24 sessions, or
wow.
in my case, an 8-week food craving program compared to 6 months for the CBT people to reach their gains and then maintain them. So I think that's the thing. So journals don't like us to write the word superior. I have to tap on that. I'm like,
right, go ahead and start tapping.
They make me write non-inferior. I'm like, oh, okay.
They say, wait, they make you write non-inferior?
Non-inferior. They're like, it's non-inferior. I'm like, well, it achieves it quicker.
I mean, so the word superior is there for a reason.
No, they've got issues. Anyway, tap, tap. So it is that, okay, it's comparable. That's a good thing. It means there's another choice. You used the word choice before. People have a choice then of what they want to access, knowing the validity is there and the evidence. But if time and cost is an issue or access, so rural, remote people, they can achieve the outcomes as a gold standard but in a faster time point. And sometimes that's important for people, you know, particularly if something's going on at health crisis level or money won't stretch for 24 sessions, you know, that kind of thing. So that's what I'm all about. I was never trying to prove that EFT was better than anything else that we've been teaching for donkey's years, because of course we know those kind of things work, but it is efficient in terms of its application and for regulation. And I'm probably just impatient. I'm like, can we get it done quicker? And
that's how I feel too. I was talking to somebody recently and they were talking about you know, the need for really stretching it out and making it slow. And I think for some people that is so true that they need to be very delicate and take a lot of time. And of course, if they have, you know, more like complex PTSD and, you know, just making sure that you're not rushing into it. However, for me, I was like, I don't want to be anxious anymore. And I want to get there as fast as possible. And when I found tapping, I didn't know that it worked faster than other things. I just know that it worked fast for me. Yeah. So I will say that for me, it was superior to other things that I had tried in the sense that it got me results very fast and I felt it very quickly. So yeah. I'll use the word superior. You don't have to, Peter. You don't have to.
You can have it.
I will just take that for you and do that for you. So I know you do a lot of research and tapping groups with things like cravings and weight loss. What, you know, talk to me a little bit about, like, what are you the most excited about right now with that?
Yeah, so we've spent a good 12 years in that space, mainly because it was an extension of my clinical work in eating disorders. And, you know, you do need kind of lots of numbers, sample size to go through. So it was much easier to kind of go, all right, we've got an obesity crisis here in Australia. I wonder if we reduce food cravings in that there's no willpower needed. People just don't eat that food anymore because they don't desire it. Will they lose weight over time? So we've been sort of exploring that for a dozen years now. And it's not surprising, but we see so much that we still go, wow, is people forget the food that they actually did their tapping on in, you know, a 4-week program, a 6-week, an 8-week program. And when you go back to them 6 months, 12 months, we've even done 2-year follow-up, they literally can't remember the food that they
eat. Wow.
And they bring it in. So it's always exposure therapy. The food is in front of them. You should come into these groups, 15 people holding all these different food items, tapping on their roast chickens and chocolate bars and things, you know. It smells amazing. And then go, oh, I don't want to eat that. And so when you remind them, you know, even 2 years later, oh, you were eating, I don't know, 10 chocolate bars a day, they literally go, was I? And so we just still laughed.
Isn't that amazing?
Evidence of that neurological shift that I love that no willpower is needed, you know, that I watched, you know, my mother and aunties and all of those back in the 80s going through their diets and, you know, getting cranky about having to resist and feel deprived or whatever. And you kind of go, wow, we don't need any of that anymore. You just have to get rid of the intensity of that desire, and it literally leaves your repertoire of foods to the point where clients have said and participants have said over the years, oh, I don't even walk down that aisle in the supermarket. I don't even think about it. So to me, that's the freedom that, you know, really is so profound. So we've even been able to demonstrate that a self-paced version of that program online achieved the same outcomes as live sessions, meaning, again, you know, if someone just wanted to do a one-off kind of program fee or whatever, they can access that, put themselves through it, and it will still work just tapping with me on a video and walking through it. So the applications, I think, have been, you know, really amazing in that area to be able to sort of say, yeah, this stuff works. You know, if I wanted to lose weight, I probably wouldn't do anything except do tapping on food. But we do it the other way too. So people don't realize you can tap to increase your interest in healthy food so that you do want to eat salad.
Ooh, I haven't thought of that.
Veg. So we teach them that, and we also teach them how to increase their desire to want to exercise so that exercise feels like and movement feels like kind of a natural thing that you want to do every day. So we target all of that kind of in a program of an 8-week kind of length where, yeah, it's not just about, okay, get rid of those foods and hope you don't substitute it for anything else. We kind of come in from all angles to the point. And, of course, we do address the food wastage bit that epigenetically we noticed was being handed on through generations of, you know, they might have something left on the plate, and because they were taught the messages of, well, I don't want to eat it, but I have to because there's, you know, famine somewhere else in the world, or I'll feel bad and guilty if I throw it out. We address that as well so that we don't want that handed down through future generations, which we could see where that was coming from, coming out of, you know, world wars and famines and
depressions.
And yeah, so it's a really comprehensive, I'm really proud of that program, which we now have publicly available so people can access that. So I might give you a link so that people can access
it. That would be great. Yeah, I was just getting ready to ask if that was something that they could find on your website. So do you, in that, is there any of the going back and finding memories that create the emotional eating? Could you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, so we let it organically come up. So what we noticed in that kind of 12-year period was for about half of the people in a group, they were tapping simply on aspects of the food that they found really attractive. So that could be smell or taste or texture or the feeling it gave them. And when that collapsed, that was enough. It wasn't tied to anything. And then for about 50% of the rest of the participants, genuinely things would come to mind around childhood memories, either of that food or the feeling they got. So it might have been the feeling instead of the actual food. And we would show them, because they got lots of support in those group sessions, either online or in person, to be able to process those through different types of tapping techniques. So they may have been hanging onto a food purely because it replicated the feeling they got when they did their baking with grandma at Christmas time. And it was the feeling they wanted to retain, but food was the vehicle, like the cookie. That was actually an example. That lady became aware that that's where the cookie came from, was the baking with the grandma. So she didn't want to let go of the cookie because she thought she would lose the feeling. So we're able to separate that out through different tapping techniques for people. So, yeah, other people would, you know, remember when weight gain started, because they were all there to lose weight. They weren't necessarily there to lose their desire for chocolate, but they wanted to lose weight. So then we kind of would ask the right questions about, well, you know, when did you start to gain weight? Go back and look at childhood photo albums. You know, was it a message you were told because you had a critical parent, or was there something that occurred? And sometimes there were, you know, stressful or traumatic events that did occur for people kind of in that 6 to 12 months before weight gain occurred. And weight is very protective for the body subconsciously. So then we were able to help, you know, process that kind of thing. And if anything, they used to write weekly feedback anonymously, and they would always write, I came in here to lose weight and tap on my food cravings. I had no idea I would end up tapping on But, you know, I'm so glad that I did. So, yeah, we let it come up naturally. We weren't trying to get them, but, yeah, there's ways to do that in tapping, of course. And we would always say, if you think of anything else while you're tapping, you must tell us. Don't dismiss it.
Yes, because when we tap, those memories just start to come forward. I actually do that craving talk in some events sometimes. And it's actually like my favorite talk to do it, because I love tapping with people with their chocolate in front of them and their chips. And, you know, it's fun. And also you see the light bulbs going off in people and they're like, whoa. I had a girlfriend that I tapped with a cookie addiction. And she, I think, might still be mad at me because she never looked at those cookies again. She was like, they actually smell disgusting.
My husband, who's an engineer, not in my world at all, we tapped with him for a certain type of chocolate bar, and that was probably 15 years ago. He still says to this day, you ruined those chocolate bars for me. And I'm like, Do you ever feel like one? And he's like, no. But that doesn't matter. You ruined them. I'm like, okay.
Yeah, you broke me. You broke it. Well, so what would you say about the very first time I tapped for craving? I wasn't actually strongly in a craving, but it was in a, you know, in a EFT course, and I love chocolate. But when I tapped, it actually tasted better. What would you say about that? That hasn't happened to me ever again since then, but it actually tasted better. I could smell it more. So what would you say about that?
Sometimes when we vary person food, you know, if we're having it there as that exposure element, obviously can make it quite impactful. The first time we tap and tune into maybe, you know, an aspect, and that could be smell or taste or whatever it might be, often you actually engage with it. So it's like that part of the brain engages. And so as you start to tap, you might become more aware of the intensity of the smell. It might be really creamy or chocolatey or whatever, or sweet. But as you keep tapping, so sometimes people will take that as tapping didn't work, but normally it's only that very first kind of step, because if you keep tapping on what's standing out to you, it actually will start to decrease. So anyone even out there tapping, perhaps, you know, with an internet video or whatever, might find that something feels more intense even as a feeling when you first start tapping and saying out loud or engaging with what's happening. And again, don't take that as meaning, oh, tapping didn't work because my number out of 10 got higher. It actually means, no, that's where you need to start. So we would just say the answer is keep tapping and it will actually kind of
keep going. Yeah. And it was in a workshop, so I'm sure it was like a short, you know, maybe like 5 or 10 minute thing. So we didn't keep going with it, but it's never happened since. Usually when I tap and I have a craving, it's just kind of like, it just goes away and I don't even think about it anymore. But you brought up something important that I was going to talk about. I was in a conversation with someone recently and it was kind of like in passing, and someone made a comment and I thought, I'm going to talk to PETA about this. And she said, she was talking about EMDR and she said, I tried EMDR and I know EMDR is incredibly effective. I don't know a ton about it, but I know that it is so, so, so powerful. And she said, I didn't like EMDR. It triggered me. Mm. And, I guess I would love for you to continue with that thought, because we know that it's not necessarily that it's triggering you. It's just bringing it to the surface. Am I right?
Yeah. So EMDR and DFT, and we would say that, you know, we're talking about a fourth wave in the therapy space being more of these somatic based. EMDR would be included with that, in that kind of area, coming out of that cognitive kind of third wave and derivatives like acceptance and commitment therapy and things like that. So, and like I said, EMDR has taken 20 odd years to kind of be embraced, but both EFT and EMDR are different to the third wave because they actually require you to engage with either the distressing memory, the distressing feeling, whatever's happening, food cravings, you know, the aspects, just quick enough in the beginning to kind of get it engaged in the body. What happens then, and this is where, you know, we would often say, probably don't do your own tapping with an internet video where it's not someone that's live, that it's a pre-recorded if there's distress, because unless you're, I guess, you know, courageous enough or strong enough to push through and keep tapping, then if you abandon at that point where you've brought it up but you haven't done anything to shift it, you will feel overwhelmed and you will feel more distressed. Or like she said, I was triggered by it. Mm-hmm. But all that tells me is it was abandoned at that point and the technique wasn't done, because EMDR taxes the working memory. So they use a bit of bilateral tapping as well. But when you hold that memory and then move the eyes, the brain can't do those two activities at once, hold distress, move the eye. So that their mechanism, if you like, is about the working memory is taxed because of the eye movement. Mm-hmm. But if she didn't do that, or some of the other aspects, they use tone and they use tapping as well, then she would have been just left with that heightened state. And it's the same with tapping, that, you know, if someone pulls up a video, and it is why we say, look, internet tapping is completely different to what you do in clinical EFT. If you tap, become aware of a memory, and then abandon ship, you're left with that high level of distress. We say it actually shows you the technique worked really quickly, but you didn't finish it. So, yeah, if anything, I would encourage someone like that to either go back and have someone support them and finish it, or at least try EFT or one of the other fourth wave approaches.
Yeah. And I didn't, you know, like I said, it was kind of in passing. So I didn't ask further questions. Like, you know, did the intensity come down afterwards? And did you just not like being, you know, in that intensity in the session? Or was it that you were kind of left hanging with it when you left? I didn't ask, but I do, you know, I get those kinds of questions. And I always say it's not rainbows and butterflies, you know, and we just have to kind of get through it. But you get through it and then it's gone. It's just gone. So the other question I get, and I have people comment a lot after I do like workshops and stuff, they say, you know, I really prefer the tapping where I just like the videos where I just say affirmations the whole time. And I'm like, I know.
Yep.
I like that too, but it's not actually going to get in and, you know, help neutralize some of that discomfort underneath there. So yeah. I don't know if you have anything to add to that.
Yeah, there is a massive movement out there, you know, of positive tapping, and there's nothing wrong with positive tapping. We just encourage that we don't do any positive tapping till we've cleared whatever might happen. Otherwise, a bit like affirmations, they take a very long time to work otherwise, because the little voice in the back of the head that might go, you're not happy, you're not attracting wealth every day. Like, you might be saying that statement or affirmation as you tap, but if the little voice in the back of the head, people forget that that's actually the driver, and your world won't change. And again, people might think tapping didn't work, but it's like, because you've applied it incorrectly. It's not designed to tap on affirmations or positively. It's designed to actually decrease distress or a limiting belief around, you know, wealth and abundance or creation or whatever. It's designed to reduce whatever the issue is there, so the other part can open up to, you know, attract it, allow it, manifest it, whatever it might be. When people learn that, then that's my most favorite way of using tapping these days in my life, is goal setting. But all I've got to do is tap on why hasn't it come true yet? When I do that, then it can open up. So I don't have to do positive tapping after that. So
Yeah, I think there's, you know, I like to let people have their positive tapping, and I do positive tapping sometimes, but I'm with you. It's at the end of actually clearing something. And then I feel like the feeling just gets amplified drastically by the positive tapping. Whereas if I just tap and say positive things, I don't normally feel a huge shift, maybe a little bump of energy or something, but I don't feel too much. But I also think that, like, deep down inside, I have a lot of resistance. I don't know. I don't know that everybody has as much resistance as I do.
But I probably do.
I think I'm like a real pain in the ass, if I'm honest, you know.
You can tap on that, Kelly. It'll be all right.
I do all the time. No, I mean, I can have a sense of humor about it, but I do sometimes wonder. I'm like, I just don't know that so many people, I think it is because I do have, you know, the part of me that believes in magic. And then I also have this very skeptical part of me that's like, I don't believe that. I don't buy that. I can't manifest that, you know? So it's a lot to work with over here. How would you describe, from a very grounded psychologist perspective, what manifestation is?
Oh, my brain instantly went more to the magical. It's probably
I mean, that's fine too. I mean, I'm here for it. I'm always here for it.
Joe Dispenza's a close friend. I do research with him, and he talks more in the kind of quantum world. How would I ingrounded? At some level, the alignment between, like even from a quantum physics point of view, the alignment between your desire and if we kind of go, all right, well, if it was the object of desire or it was sort of, you know, here away from you, it's the alignment of your kind of desire level, if you like, to the possibility that that is something that is in your future. Or for some people, they're like, it already exists out there. Joe talks like that. But it is about you coming in line with. But we know from, you know, goal setting research or EFT or whatever, that there also has to be the recognition of the internal belief system or mental blocks or whatever you want to call them that prevent that from becoming a reality for you. Because, you know, really, people could achieve anything they want to. The goal setting research now strongly suggests it's not enough to just imagine, if you like, or visualize that it's already come true in my life. The brain actually, we're primed to deal with problems. We're primed to actually scan for threat. So the goal setting research actually says you actually do need to imagine, visualize yourself overcoming what it would take for that to come true. And that is a much more powerful manifestation process. So that comes straight out of the science literature, which is a kind of make it's more acceptable to people as well to kind of say, all right, well, maybe what I have to imagine is that I sit down and do the tapping and I see myself dedicating an hour a day to doing my tapping and journaling on that or whatever it might be. So even to imagine seeing yourself makes it more acceptable that that's a possibility for me for that to. But otherwise, it really is just coming into alignment, whether you want to say that's energetic or at a belief sure. system level. Possibility.
Okay. So I want to talk about this a little bit more because Laura brought that research up as well. And I think that makes a lot of sense. And coming back to that alignment piece of it, you mentioned like the goal setting and then that little voice in our head, right? Where it's like, yes, I want to go after that. And then that voice that comes in is like, yeah, but, mm-hmm. and gives us all the reasons why that can't happen. And that's, you know, the negative skeptic and inner critic and all that. So tapping helps us to like really deal with that part of us that isn't in alignment with our goal. Did I say that right?
Yes. Yeah.
And then, so if you were doing something like you wanted to manifest more money, more financial abundance, what are some of the, I know this might sound like a weird question, but what are some of the specific obstacles that you would recommend people kind of visualizing and thinking through?
Yeah, we would ask, you know, first up, you know, what does more money mean? Like, give me a more specific kind of, you know, is it a dollar value per month? Just say someone comes up with, I don't know, $1,000 extra a month. Okay, mm-hmm. don't have to worry about where that comes from. But so the next question really is to get the tail end is to actually sort of say, so why don't you have that extra $1,000 a month now? Because whatever next comes out your mouth, we would always say, write those down. They become the reasons, the rationales, the justifications in the, that's that little voice in the back of your head. We can work out where they come from later, but it is about saying, well, why hasn't that happened yet? Now tell me all the reasons. And we don't judge them. We just dump them on a page. They then become the tapping statements if we're using EFT, where we kind of go, all right, well, how strongly do you feel about that out of 10? Let's just take one at a time. Let's tap on them until they no longer feel that strength or that truth about them. Because people will go, oh, I don't know why I believe that. Let's move on to the next one and the next one and the next one. And all we're doing is sort of lessening the strength of those kind of beliefs or reasons, whatever you want to call them, until they're kind of close to zero out of 10. And then people might state that kind of claim again or that goal, I really want to earn $1,000 extra a month. How do I feel that that's a possibility? Don't have to think where it comes from. If the possibility is like, yeah, I think that's completely doable or possible, you know, that might represent 9 out of 10 in terms of numbers, then we can either let it go and see what happens, or they might want to start to brainstorm how could that possibly. And so it opens up that part of the brain that is creative, and mm-hmm. because that's the part that's often being closed down for solutions and possibility because of the fear and the negativity and the worry and the limiting beliefs. So, yeah, all we're doing in goal setting or manifestation is working out, well, why hasn't it happened already? That kind of thing.
And then you answer that and it just feeds you all of your beliefs about it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's brilliant.
I'll give you an example just from, because it just came to mind. So my husband has a belief that he is very lucky. That's a nice belief to have. He just goes, I'm a very lucky person. So my daughter, a couple of years ago, she would have been about 14, she said, so how come you haven't won Lotto yet? He doesn't even buy Lotto tickets. But she goes, okay, you believe you're very lucky. He's got string of evidence of where that's come true. And he goes, oh, I don't buy Lotto tickets. She goes, I know, but if you believe you're very lucky, then you probably believe. And he says, oh, I don't want to waste my luck on the Lotto ticket. And that was my face. And I went, oh. I go, what does that mean? And he goes, oh, because the luck is limited.
Oh, my gosh.
So we went, oh, write those down.
Tap.
I'm like, what are you tapping? And he went, no. And I'm like, okay. So to this day, it still stands. But it's just the conversation about, so why hasn't that happened, or why isn't that the case, or whatever. So, yeah, it's such an interesting question. And sometimes it can make people feel defensive because that's their belief. And unless you're ready to start to uncover it and do your tapping and change it, people feel safe with their beliefs and so they want to keep them. So, yeah, it just popped in them. Like, oh, yeah, he won't waste his luck on a lotto ticket.
I love that. And so I'm like envisioning you like, please, can we just tap on that?
Yes, I'm like, oh.
Please. Yeah, I'm always begging I'm like, come on, baby, let's just tap on that. And he's like, no, I don't want to. I love that story. It's funny because when you asked the question, the first thing that popped in my head was, I'm not doing enough. And I was like, oh no, there's that again.
Yes, yeah.
Back to the drawing board.
Then you can go deeper, you know, you can really take that down the table leg and kind of go, all right, well, what's that about? Where did that come from? And it may go back to where the belief was formed. And it could be about the opposite, that if I wasn't doing enough, that got, you know, judged growing up, and we don't have to go there. But do you know what I mean? Like, you can then take that down. And sometimes it feels like what you're tapping on or working on, it's got nothing to do with the first thing of the goal of what you wanted, which was, I want an extra $1,000 a month. But when you clear it, it clears so much that not only is that extra money, you know, a given or a possibility, so many other things may have been impacted by clearing that one kind of childhood memory or belief or whatever comes to mind. Like, it's almost like you're going on an exploration and discovery to go, where does this come from?
Yes, I love it. It's funny when you said that you wanted to be an attorney, I thought, you know, I can see that because they need to understand the psychology of the people in the courtroom. And there is this investigative process that totally overlaps with what you do. So I could see that. I could also see how it wasn't quite the right fit, but
I think the whole lecturing of what I do now, you know, might do kind of speeches at conferences, but teaching, I teach intensively for 8 hours, my students. And it's that similar, it's that sharing of knowledge, you know, our research is the investigation. And it's like, oh, the elements were there. It's just that was the wrong kind of job. There's no way I'd want to work 80 hours a week. I'm like, oh, no.
Thank you. Yeah. No, thank you. Oh, my gosh. I love it. Let me just scan here and see if there's anything. I think I could keep going. I'm not going to keep you too much longer, but I had 2 pages of questions. So I'm just want to make sure I hit all the major ones. I did want to ask you about are you still doing much with the tapping in classrooms?
Yes. Yeah. So we have a whole movement, if you like, out there. So we've done lots of research in schools locally and published lots of those things. But we ultimately developed Tapping in the Classroom, which is an online teacher training. So not using tapping for trauma or distress, like that level of distress, but just classroom use in terms of learning to spell or before a test for anxiety, you know, after an exam, that type of thing, regulation, tiredness, that sort of thing. And so it's a 20-hour professional developed training online that teaches, and we've had thousands of teachers worldwide access that program now. And obviously, not knowing anything about tapping, it gives you enough that you can actually start to use it. We've had whole schools that from Alaska right through to Melbourne here, every teacher is trained in tapping and can use it. And the students ask, they're like, we forgot to do our tapping before the test. We've got to do our tapping. So they give us this feedback and things. So it kind of has a life of its own out there, but we support them in anything they need. And we do know through our kind of evaluation of that, that, yeah, it's just a really nice adjunct for teachers.
Oh, it's
And there's a whole component for teachers to do it for themselves. So on their own stress, of course, that they can do that privately at home. But because we know teacher burnout is such a big thing in the first 5 years of graduating, that they leave the profession because there's no longer a calling, or what they're dealing with, you know, is not what they envisage this would be like. So tapping can really support them as well. So, yeah, we absolutely have it out there.
I love the idea of that being in the classroom. I think that would have been a game changer for me, you know, not for anything other than just, like you said, sitting down before a test and doing the tapping, because I was that kid that would sit down and all of the information would be like, zoop, it's just gone. And I remember sitting in my first EFT conference and them talking about how that, like, that rational thinking and your frontal lobes kind of go offline and the blood drains away from them. And I thought, well, that's exactly what has been happening to me every time I take a test for my whole freaking life. I was like high functioning anxiety. I could get through it, but it really was inside was a struggle, and it felt very unpredictable and very, you know, times I could get through it and be fine. And sometimes I would just be hijacked and feel like I was sitting there just, you know, staring blankly at a page, like, I don't even know what room I'm in, you know?
Yeah. So. And you're not alone. You know, so many students are affected by that. So even to learn discrete tapping, like our lot learn that here. So we see them in exams and they're kind of rubbing the point and, you know, they're squeezing the fingernails, which is good because they can just calm that all down so that the information they studied can come back in. Mm-hmm. Because, yeah, so lots of research in that test anxiety space exists.
And definitely with the like performance anxiety, again, I could do it, but I mean, inside I was a mess. I could do it. I could get it done. But, you know, I had like the cotton mouth and like my heart pounding out of my chest and my throat would turn bright red, and somehow I would manage to get through. But afterwards I felt like I had just been through war. It was horrible. It was horrible. Peta, you were going to come back to,
Yes, the translational gap.
Yes. Yes.
It might be a nice kind of wrap up. So that kind of phenomenon exists in medical research, in our research, where it takes sort of 17 to 20 years for something to kind of emerge through research to be accepted in mainstream. So EFT is sitting at that kind of 17, 18 year mark from when the research really started. So in late 2021, I'm trying to get November 2021, the American Psychological Association approved my team. So I have a team all around the world in this project to evaluate EFT for trauma and post-traumatic stress disorder, to evaluate the evidence for inclusion on their evidence-based psychological website. So they have a list of interventions. So they approved that. We then took 10 months, so it was a big project, obviously had to evaluate lots of data, submitted that in October 2022, so only a few months ago. They have given us their preliminary feedback. So you're the first person I've ever told this to.
And I have goosebumps. I'm so excited to hear this.
And I do too now. I must say the feedback and evaluation, we have to resubmit, which we're actually days away from doing. But the feedback was almost designed in that, please do this. Please say this, in that I found it very supportive. So we still obviously have to wait for, but we're talking about a meta-analysis here. That's why we updated that and the effect size. I can tell you the data shows that effect size of 1.86 for EFT over, you know, waiting list, control groups doing nothing, and it's equivalent to CBT, EMDR. So that's what that paper, that report will say. And so we just really have to wait for the APA to say, yes, we accept this, we double check the data and list it on the website. So that will be that 18 year mark. So when people sort of go, placebo or whatever, it's like, well, this is what we've been waiting for. You know, it's very close. We already have a string that's long of organizations that approve EFT worldwide, you know, from here to America, to the UK, to Canada. Loads of people have already approved it for use, and, you know, it's been kind of qualitatively and quantitatively evaluated as being evidence-based. So, but the APA is what people want to hear. So when people go, oh, is there any evidence? What they really want to hear is, has the APA approved it? So that's where we're at. So I'll come back and do a follow-up with you in a couple months.
Oh my gosh, that is so exciting. I mean, I'm seriously, when you started talking about it, I had full body goosebumps. I know how long everybody's been waiting for this. And so once that is considered evidence-based, what does that mean for people that are, you know, that want to have this done as a therapy, that want to find someone? What does that mean for them?
Yeah, so it will have that trickle effect through to, you know, practitioners in the field, whether they're licensed or not, because there is this kind of overarching body that says, yes, we think, but we've got to remember our evaluation has only been for PTSD and trauma. That same evaluation would have to be done for lots of other conditions, which eventually would happen over time anyway, e.g. weight loss or phobias or depression or whatever it might be. So this was the starting point. So ultimately, it will mean that perhaps, you know, practitioners in the field will have more clients reach out to them because they feel confident that maybe there's, you know, this overarching support from, you know, an evidence-based organization.
Incredibility.
And, you know, ultimately it might mean that, you know, Medicare and organizations like that will, you know, do rebates for those that are licensed and able to claim so that people aren't out of pocket. We already have lots of organizations that, you know, it's freely available, but it's probably exactly what you said. It's the credibility for some people and, you know, Wikipedia and beyond. It's kind of hard to then say, well, if it's on the APA website, whenever that occurs, that, you know, it's placebo because they've decided that, no, it's not, that kind of thing. So, yeah. So it's not far away. I mean, we've been saying, look, we've been at a tipping point for about 5 years, but this really has been kind of the ultimate.
It's huge.
And to be honest, did you want to know what I tap on? I'm like, I didn't want to do this. Why I got this job? Like,
how did I end up here?
I'm like,
you were the woman. You were the woman for the job, apparently. Yeah. Thank you, universe.
At the same time, it is that kind of responsibility and
oh, it's huge.
Like we can only work with what we've got, and yes, it tells a story. To be honest, I have no idea what they'll say in the evaluation at the end. If not, then, you know, it is just a matter of knowing where the research has to go from here. So, yeah. I did resist. You talk about resist. I had resistance.
You have resist. We all do. You're probably not as much of a pain as I am, though.
I did do tapping.
Yeah. Lots of tapping. I mean, I'm so much better. At least I know I have my resistance now.
Yes.
I'm an Aquarius. I don't know if you're an astrology person, but like, I'm like that, like rebel without a cause kind of person. So I have to make sure my rebellion is like in alignment with something that's functional, that's productive. Just be like, I don't want to do that. This was so fun. Thank you so much for being here. This is, like I said, this is a huge manifestation for me getting to talk to you. I just think you're a lovely human and I do think you're super cool. So
tell my daughters.
Tell everyone.
Great. I will. It's always fabulous to talk about tapping and the science and the evidence and what's happening.